Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S., designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. I say good blizzard to you.
Hey guys, pretty snowy outside.
Yeah,
winter weather.
A lot like the snow in Sundance. How's Sundance?
It was great. It didn't actually snow while I was there, but there was snow.
There was snow on the ground.
I saw some great films. In fact, I saw the film that John Ronson talks about in the podcast
He
co-wrote, which is hilarious and amazing. It's called Frank. I don't know when it'll be out generally, but I loved it.
Right on.
Who'd you talk to this week, Aaron?
I talked to Roger Hodge. He is the current editor of Oxford American. He's the former editor of Harper's. In a relatively short span, he's seen a lot of upheaval in the world of magazine publishing, and he had a lot of interesting things to say about that.
That's a great magazine, too, Oxford American.
Yeah. Their latest issue, the Southern Music Issue, is fantastic.
And it's really on good. The newsstands now. And it comes with a CD, which he gave me, but I was unable to play because I don't have a CD player. Do we have any sponsors this week?
We do. We have a pair. The first is Tiny Letter. It's a simple, elegant way to send an email newsletter. It's done by the good people of MailChimp. We thank them for their sponsorship.
Additionally, we're sponsored by Random House, who have a great new book out, Gary Steingart's Little Failure. I literally started it on the train ride here, and I will report back as I progress through it.
All right. Here's Aaron with Roger Hodge.
Welcome, Roger Hodge.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Just getting started. I had you on my list of people to have on the show for a while, and I assumed that you lived in Arkansas until I did get to talk to someone who started working for you, and she said, "No, he's in Park Slope."
But I do live in Brooklyn.
Okay, we won't disclose your exact location.
Well, it's been published. it's Ditmas Park, so no mysteries there.
So despite your Ditmas Park location, you are editing Oxford American, which is based in Arkansas,
yes,
Little Rock?
Little Rock and Conway.
How long have you been at the helm there?
I joined in September 2012.
September 20th, 2012. So for people, I think most people listening will have some familiarity with the magazine, but for people who haven't picked it up, what is Oxford American?
The Oxford American is a literary quarterly that explores the diversity and vitality of Southern culture. We have a long and storied literary history, but we also do a lot of music coverage, a lot of journalism, and we publish poetry, fiction, etc. So in some ways it's a general interest magazine devoted to the Southern United States. And my approach to what the South is pretty loose. I think of it as the greater South. I'm not too hung up on Southern stereotypes. I'm not too hung up on whether my writers are from the South or live in the South. I don't live in the South, although I'm from the South.
Yeah. When you're talking to someone, say who is interested in writing for Oxford American, what kind of a pitch are you looking for? I mean, what kind of a story, especially in terms of your features, what boxes are you trying to check off when you think about what you want to see on the cover?
I don't have any boxes, really. I don't have a recipe. Hmm. I'm just looking for good stories. And if the story takes place in the South, if it's connected to the South, if it passes through the South, it doesn't really matter. I mean, mm-hmm. really, I'm just looking for stories. And I'm not gonna reject a pitch just because there's no Southern hook. In fact, I don't like stories that make a big deal about the South. I'm impatient with the mythology of the South and the trappings of Southernness. I think we've had enough of that. It's no big deal. The South is a defined region. It has an identity, but it doesn't have a fixed identity. It's not just one thing either. The South is really a collection of regions rather than one region. And so I don't have boxes that I check off. I look for good stories. I look for good writing.
I was very impressed in the most recent issue, which I think is the music issue.
Mm-hmm. The Tennessee music issue.
You've got Roseanne Cash, Jim Dickinson, who played piano on Wild Horses, I believe. And these like pretty incredible lineup of musicians, but these aren't people who are known for their writing. How do you put together an issue like that that is largely based around non-writers?
Yeah, that it's interesting that many of the pieces in that issue were written by musicians. The Roseanne piece came about because her A&R person at Blue Note got in touch with me to let me know that she had this new album coming out. And Roseanne has written for the magazine in the past. So then it was a question of just having a conversation. I went into the studio to hear an early mix of the album. And Roseanne dropped by and we started talking and we hatched this plan for an essay. And she wasn't exactly sure what the essay was going to be, but it was, again, it's a conversation. And she wrote this beautiful piece integrating some of her new songs from the album. And then we put a song from the album on our CD because we include a double CD with the issue. And then she came and played in Little Rock in our restaurant. We have a restaurant and performance space.
Oh, wow.
In Little Rock.
Sounds delightful.
Called South on Main. And so she played that and kind of launched the issue for us.
Yeah.
Jim Dickinson, he died, gosh, I'm not even sure.
2 or 3 years
ago. A little further back than that even. But we found out about this manuscript, this book-length memoir that he had written. And so we got it. And it's amazing. It's beautiful. And it's a portrait of the artist as a young musician for the most part. But then there are all these great stories like the Rolling Stones scene where he's with the Stones at Muscle Shoals. The issue didn't take us that far. I mean, the piece, which is 16,000 words.
Yeah.
did not go that far. It didn't go that far into his career.
Right.
It was mostly the arc of his development as a musician. And I was focusing in the edit on his obsession with the color line and his quest as a young man, as a boy, to find this music. That's the angle we followed, the thread we followed through the piece. And so we had to leave a lot of great stuff out. But I suspect this book will be published.
So this journey that has taken you to Oxford American is sort of a round trip for you in a way, in that you are from the South. And where did you start becoming interested in writing?
Oh, I always was. I grew up in Del Rio, Texas, went to public schools. So I encountered writers in school, for the most part, I think, Dostoevsky and although Kafka, Kafka was one of the big, landmarks in my education as a reader and thus as a writer.
I don't know anything about Del Rio. Kafka unusual in Del Rio?
Probably, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a little bitty town on the Mexican border.
Mm.
So the books that made a big impact on me were Crime and Punishment, the collected short writings of Kafka, and The Sound and the Fury. Those were the big, the books that kind of blew my mind when I was a kid. Of course, I probably read 600 science fiction novels before I came in contact with them. And I remember the moment when I was, after I had read Faulkner or someone, and then I read a science fiction novel, I thought, there's a lot of great science fiction, don't get me wrong, but the particular one that I turned, it was the moment when I realized, this is crap. This book, whatever this book was, it was terrible. And it was this critical moment where I realized, there's some writing that's good and there's some writing that's not good. This just happened to be a science fiction book that I was reading. That was a landmark in my memory. By the time I got to Suwannee, I went to the University of the South in Tennessee.
Glad you said that before me, because I was going to go for Suwannee.
By the time I got to Suwannee, I knew I wanted to be a writer or an editor or something like that. I didn't know exactly what.
Yeah.
And that was a great place to be if you wanted to be a writer.
What was it like? I know nothing about it.
Well, Suwannee just has a great literary atmosphere, a great literary tradition. The Suwannee Review is one of the great little magazines in American letters. Alan Tate was there, and Andrew Lytle, and it was a place that made you think, I could be a writer. The life of literature was so present. There weren't all these other distractions. If I'd gone to college in New York City, who knows which way I would have gone. All these other opportunities would have presented themselves. But at Suwannee, writing and the life of writing just seemed an obvious thing to do, or at least an obvious thing to try. Plenty of writers come out of NYU, but whether I would have, because I wasn't a strongly formed personality when I got to college. I was just a kid. I didn't know what I wanted to do.
When you were done with school, became an intern at Harper. Is that right?
No, I bounced around for a while. My wife and I, we weren't married at the time. Went to Chapel Hill, and I started writing. I started writing professionally for money. I also had a lot of other jobs. I was mostly a line cook at a bakery in Durham.
Well,
got an internship at the Independent Weekly, this alt weekly there, and started reviewing. I was doing jazz reviews for the Chapel Hill newspaper's weekend entertainment supplement, which was great because I got into every show for free and everybody was passing through town. And just started trying to be a writer. I didn't know how to be a writer. Again, still just kind of filling notebooks, trying to figure out how to find my voice as a writer or find a way to be an editor. Detoured through Florida. I worked as an insurance adjuster.
Florida seems like a good place to adjust some insurance.
It was unspeakably grim.
What brought you? You're like, screw this jazz reviewing. I'm gonna head down to Florida.
My girlfriend got a job in Jacksonville, she was from a beach town near Jacksonville. So we ended up there, and there was no literary market there. I mean, in Durham, there was a literary market. There were, you could write for the Alt Weekly. You could, at least try to get a job at the Sun, the Sun, this great old literary magazine there, or there was Algonquin Books. There were things you could try for.
A man could dream.
Yeah. You could write jazz reviews, even though you were, I would hate to go back and look at them now, but I was a fan.
We'll put them in the show.
I was a fan. I may have been an idiot, but I was a fan. But in Jacksonville, there was nothing. And I didn't know how to approach a national publication.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, do you have any sort of community? Did you know anyone who was getting paid more than you writing?
No.
Yeah.
No. And there was no internet. There was no, well, there was, but I didn't know about it. And most people didn't either. And it was hard to find out what you could do, just find out about magazines. I'd go to the library and I would read the Paris Review, I would look at different literary quarterlies, I would try to write short stories. I probably started several different novels at the time, but I didn't know how to be. I didn't know how to be a reporter. I didn't know how to be a the kind of writer I ended up becoming. So I went to grad school, like any confused recent grad. Eventually, ended up in New York. I went into a PhD program in philosophy.
Ah, okay.
And got my master's in philosophy and was ABD by the time I came to my senses and got out. But that was good. That was a great education.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, academic disciplines train your mind. Whatever it is, whether it's what they used to call English, historiography, philosophy, they each have their own unique intellectual discipline. But it's not just reading and writing. It's a body of knowledge and an approach to that body of knowledge that trains your mind. You have to enter into that and master it. And entering into an academic discipline and attempting to master it is a valuable undertaking. Once I realized I wasn't suited to be a scholar, certainly not to be a philosopher, I came to my senses and went back to my original plan, which was try to make my way as a writer or editor. But I always wanted to work at Harper's. Harper's was my ultimate goal.
Had you tried to just go work at Harper's before? Or?
Well, I met when I was at Swanee. I met Jack Hitt, who's a great writer,
wonderful,
and at
writer.
The time was an editor at Harper's.
Oh, that's right.
And he and I shared a mentor, a Spanish professor named Tom Spicarelli, who had a huge impact at me at Swanee, and met Jack. And Jack told me that I should come to New York and try to work at Harper's as an intern. He told me about the internship. So I always wanted to do that. And so when I got to the point where I was either write my dissertation or not, I applied to the internship at Harper's and I got turned down. But I lived in New York. So when somebody else quit on the second day, they called me. So I went in. And then someone quit, the fact checker quit, and then they hired me. And I was a fact checker for 9 months. And I loved fact-checking, but fact-checking has a expiration date.
I've done some fact-checking. Probably about 9 months of fact-checking.
Yeah, it's all you need. And really, you should approach it as a tool, how to write a magazine article. That's what I approached fact-checking as a discipline, all right? It's a discipline. This is how you make sure that this piece is not going to get the magazine sued, and it's not going to embarrass the magazine. It's not going to embarrass you and get you fired for making some stupid error. But it was a great, I mean, you got to see how all the edit, you get to see how all the different editors worked. And we had a wonderful team of editors at Harper's when I got there. And, you know, there are Lewis, of course, and Ben Metcalf and Paul Tough, who later went on to edit Saturday Night and writes books on education, and Joel Lovell, and Charis Khan and Ellen Rosenbusch, all these great people to learn from. And so I learned to be an editor from watching them.
Hey, it's your host, Aaron Lammer, with a quick word from our sponsor, Random House. A couple of weeks ago, Random House was promoting George Saunders' 10th of December story collection. This week, they are promoting Gary Steingart's Little Failure. You probably know Gary Steingart from his fiction and The New Yorker, his books Super Sad Love Story,
Russian Debutante's Handbook. This is his first work of nonfiction. Mary Carr has called it a memoir for the ages. I just got a copy myself, about halfway through reading it and enjoying it very much. We've got an exclusive excerpt from the book this week on Longform, so go to longform.org to check that out. And thank you very much to Random House for their sponsorship. It helps make this show possible. Here I am back with Roger Hodge.
And what was the first piece that you you yourself edited there?
It's a piece by Adrian McKinty, who's a novelist, who had a novel out at the time called Orange Rhymes with Everything.
Good memory.
And very good novel. And he was a cousin of a good friend of mine in grad school. And I remembered that my friend Aaron Garrett, he's a philosopher, told me this story. Adrian's from Carrickfergus in Northern Ireland. And he told me this story that Adrian had gone back home in August, and which is a time when things get hot in all kinds of ways in Northern Ireland. So it sounded like a piece. So I was a fact checker, but I didn't want to remain a fact checker. So I called up Adrian. We had drinks. He told me the story. I asked him to write a pitch. I took it into the manuscript meeting. And everybody looked at me like I was insane.
Was that accepted protocol for like a fact checker to be like, hey, I got one too?
Not really, but I put it in the pile. And there was a lot of discussion about whether this piece was worth commissioning. I said, he'll write it on spec. And Colin Harrison was deputy editor at the time. And he said, okay, good. Do it. And Adrian did a beautiful job. It was a great piece. Came in, we ran it. And so I had my first piece.
And did you quit the fact-checking when that
No, happened? I wasn't able to until someone else left, which is typical, right? Jim Nelson was running the reading section. He left to go to GQ. He's now the editor of GQ.
I didn't know he had been at GQ that long.
And so this was 96. This was... I came to Harper's in 96, and then this was 97, early 97. And so Jim left, and I moved to the reading section. And I worked with there with Susan Burton and Joel Lovell. And
check out his long-form podcast.
Alexandra Ringe. And we had a great time doing the section. And then, you know, another person would leave.
This is the flow of life.
Yeah.
So you were there, it sounds like 10 years before you became the head over there.
That's right.
Was that, and once you got to that point where you were, I'm an editor at Harper's, which is what I wanted to do in the first place, did you have the ambition to do more, or were you like, I could keep doing this for the rest of my life?
Yeah, I think I felt like I had no ambition to go anywhere else. It never even occurred to me to go anywhere else.
Did you think at that point, wow, Harper's, this magazine and this model where we print it and we mail it to you, this is forever. Like
it was obvious to me that it was obvious to me when I got there that there were problems with the model.
Okay.
And everybody was doing websites. This is 96.
Yeah, I was going to say, when were you first aware that a magazine should have a website?
Well, I was, from the moment I knew about websites.
Yeah.
When I hadn't really paid that much attention to what people were doing with web publishing until I got to Harper's. When I was in grad school, I remember Gopher sites. We would look at Gopher sites. Which was pre-web.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, working on a mainframe or a mini. Actually, it was what they called a mini computer, which to me looks like a mainframe. It's a, you know, it's a giant. It was a giant box in the basement, and we had terminals at Swanee. But I got a Mac at the time, and I got my Mac Plus.
Great computer.
You know, without a hard drive. By the time, and I always had a Mac, right? I kept trading up. I probably had every single model, except during that time when they had 15 different computers.
The low point.
Yeah. But when I got to Harper's, they had a website already. It was a brochure. It was a very nice brochure put together by a company called Small World, which was a very good web design shop. And so, but it was obvious to me that we needed a website and we needed to put our pieces online, but it was only a couple of years before I got there that Harper's got email. You know, so there was a lot happening. When Ben Metcalf got to Harper's 3 years before I did, the magazine was still being pasted up on boards.
Wow.
So a lot had happened in a very short time.
There's just like this very small period between like digital production software coming into vogue and like the web all ruining the print business that was being built with it. I mean, it seems, you know, it's less than a decade really.
Yeah.
Before.
Well, it was, yeah, exactly. And it all happened very fast. And you had all these web publications that appeared and burned out very quickly. So
there's one.
At this time, there was Suck. There was Feed.
Feed. That's what I'm going to say. Everyone who's on this show at some point made a living like writing reviews for Feed and got paid more per word than they do now.
Oh, I don't doubt that. Feed was great. I always thought of Feed as the web version of Harper's.
We'll have to do like a oral history of Feed sometime.
What was that guy's name? And he's a writer. He writes books that are, you know, bestsellers now. Stephen Johnson.
Yeah.
Was the editor of Feed. Great guy.
Stephen Berlin Johnson, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that his byline
now? Maybe there was another Stephen Johnson who. And
a lot of people worked there. A lot of people were editors there. They had the Feed Daily, this sort of 800 word sort of, it wasn't an op-ed, it was an essay. It was a short, strong, opinionated essay. They were good. There was also Word, which was a little bit overly designed. It had all kinds of animation and all kinds of stuff moving on the page.
Crop duster flies across the screen.
Exactly.
Dust the text.
Exactly. And I think after they went out of business, all of their files were all donated to the Museum of Modern Art or something. And then you had Suck. And in 1995, if you can still go to the Suck archive.
Yeah, we'll put this in the show notes. There's a great story about Wired did a great story on the rise and fall of Suck.com.
Yeah, and so if you go to the Suck archives, the very first post that's archived there is "The net giveth and the net taketh away," because we still talked about the net.
Yeah.
Then, and it's true. All those great creative magazines, they came up, but they didn't have a business model.
What did people at Harper say when someone, hey, we're going to do Feed, which is Harper's on the web? Like, what was the attitude, the sort of competitive attitude towards them then?
Well, only the young people on staff were aware of this.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we were seeing this and we were saying, this stuff is really fun. I mean, some of it's good, some of it's bad. Can't we do something like this?
Mm.
Can't we do some version of that that leverages what we do so well? And why can't, you know, why don't we outdo them at what they're doing?
Were because writers like overlapping between them?
Not much. Not really. Not at first. And, you know, the Salon shows up at about that time too.
Right.
Salon comes in at the late.
And Salon kind of had the most money, but they were the kind of the funded
Salon
model.
Well, Feed was funded too. They had venture capital.
Oh, that's right.
And they had a burn rate. then they formed Plastic.
Oh, okay.
And so they spun off into Plastic, which was going to be the Slashdot model.
So what did they think that the business, I mean, you said they didn't have a business model, but
They had a business plan, but they thought advertising would come along and they were a little too early.
They were right and wrong.
Yeah. So Plastic came along and Plastic was the Slashdot model and it was going to be user generated content. And again, they were a little too early on that too. My career has overlapped with this whole transformation, this whole revolution in publishing. And so I saw all of these, I saw several generations of web magazines arise and and burn out. None of them were making enough money to sustain themselves. And ultimately, what's left? Well, mostly it's all the old dinosaur magazines. Most of us are still around.
Yeah. Most,
and,
not all.
Not all. I mean, some of them were killed for bad reasons that were not really responsible. But, you know, the New Yorker, Atlantic, Harper's. The Atlantic is the one who eventually became the most aggressive online, to the point where the web presence really overshadows the print.
They're publishing a lot.
They sure are. And I think they've done a great job in adapting to the new marketplace. I personally think there's maybe too much there.
Yeah.
There's so much there that it's hard to navigate.
Right. I want to get to the present day, but so you moved up at Harper's in 2006-ish?
Yes.
2006. So we're sort of halfway along this evolution, this yeah. internet evolution.
So Lewis left to start the Quarterly, Lapham's Quarterly.
Great magazine.
And much to my surprise, it fell to me. I had been deputy.
How long had Lewis been there before he took off?
28 years, maybe. Yeah.
So when you took that job, you were like, okay, set my retirement clock now.
Well, yeah, I suppose. It was a challenging environment for reasons I won't go into. But I knew that I wouldn't be there for 28 years.
Okay.
From the very beginning. And I wasn't.
What did you feel like your mandate was when you took the reins?
Well, I think my mandate was to continue to publish the magazine. That was to sort of keep the project going. We always thought of Harper's as this multi-generational American project that for whatever, you know, that we were fortunate enough to participate in for our brief time. And I've always thought of Harper's as a tradition, a living tradition. And so to keep the faith, really, not to be static, not to publish a museum piece, but to keep the magazine evolving and keep the magazine innovative and do good work and start some fires. And we did. We had a great time, but we've jumped ahead a little bit because what we did before I became editor was we started along this path toward a very robust web presence.
This is the Paul Ford era.
With Paul.
Yeah, he's been on other stories about this. Check out Paul Ford's long form podcast.
So I'd been reading F-Train.
Yeah.
And I went to Paul and I said, Paul, would you meet with me? In my ideal world, Paul Ford would be designing the Harper's website.
So you knew about Paul Ford pre-Harper. He was well known enough for his writing online. It's completely hard to tell, like, who knows about, you know, this is a very early time.
You have to understand, I was a serious web aficionado. I mean, I was trying to teach myself Perl. I was trying to figure out a way to build the Harper's the digital Harper's that I had in my mind.
Yeah.
And I came across F-Train and I read Paul and Paul's writings about information architecture. And I went deep into that. And so I thought, well, why should I try to learn all this stuff? That's ridiculous. I'll get Paul to do it. So I brought Paul in. And managed to get him on staff, and I had already taken the website through one or two iterations, and had been writing an online column, the Weekly Review, for years. So Paul came in, and I helped him build this site kit for Harper's.org that was great. It was a great site kit, and it could have been an amazing website. As it was a pretty good website.
What do you mean? I'm not familiar with the term SiteKit, like a content management system?
Yeah. Well, it was more than a content management system. It was the engine beneath the content management system that was so flexible. And he ended up throwing it out and rewriting it several times. But the idea was we were going to, and we built the archive, century and a half archive of Harper's in-house, scanned it all at 666 Broadway.
Who was doing all the scanning? I feel like I asked Paul this too, but I don't remember the answer. Who scanned all that stuff?
Paul.
By himself.
Well, he had some help. He got this big sheet feeder. We made a deal with the library. We got a library archive of the magazine and cut it.
So they let you cut the 1902 Harper's on the spine? Wow.
We cut it and scanned it, fed it through.
You must have thought this was a very daring project at the time. No one had their archive up at that juncture, I don't think.
The New Yorker had its CDs.
The CDs, right, yeah.
Some people had archives. The TLS had an archive behind a paywall. Most of these archives were behind paywalls.
Right.
And you had to subscribe to them separately from magazines.
It's amazing how far we have not come since then. The New Yorker digital edition is just the CD on your computer.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're gonna blow that up. But I heard a rumor. But I don't know.
I've heard the same rumor.
So we built this great digital archive, and then we were forced to keep it behind the paywall. But at least we got it open to subscribers.
Did you think otherwise?
It was never completely clear. The signals were changing day to day, but the idea we were going to be able to leverage that archive to do all kinds of amazing things. Paul and I had big plans.
tell me about it.
We were going to leverage. There's so much information out there that is just there.
Yeah,
it's not really being organized and exploited. All this radio, going way back. TV going way back. You could build timelines if you have a 150, 160 year archive of American history in your magazine, you can take that and start reaching out to this other information that's available, that's in archive.org and all these other repositories where it's hard to get to, and pull it out and build these things on the fly using these scripts that Paul wrote. They were there. But we weren't really permitted to do it. So then by the time I became editor, I was hoping that as editor, I could push us further in that direction so that Harper's wouldn't be just this print magazine that was becoming more and more irrelevant because nobody could get to it.
Right.
And it was, it was reaching its 230,000 print subscribers. But it wasn't
that many. That's a lot. That's people are going to hear that and have their mind blown that Harper's was reaching 230,000.
It still is.
Yeah,
I'm sure. I'm sure the circulation hasn't really fallen. And we were reaching people. We would put selective pieces out.
Yeah.
The one piece that we ever published first online was Scott Horton's Guantanamo Suicides piece, which won a National Magazine Award for reporting, and is what I think got me fired because I pushed so hard to get that out online before it went into print.
What was your reasoning behind putting that out before?
Because the source needed it to be out.
Ah, okay.
It needed to be out before we could get it into print.
Hmm.
Multiple sources. That piece was so well sourced. So my mandate, my personal mandate as editor of Harper's was to push that magazine into the 21st century,
into the future, or at least the present,
and to continue to publish a great print magazine, but to use all of those resources and to really expand that digital strategy, I guess you call it, in such a way that we would be able to really reach a vast audience, the kind of audience it should be reaching. the magazine, the Harper's is still a good magazine.
It's great.
But you know, it's not really part of the...
It's not part of the discourse.
Discourse, because it's hidden.
And the people...
Deliberately hidden.
The people who write consistently for Harper's and make their career writing out of Harper's are largely off the map as writers to people who don't read Harper's.
Well, look at Tom Frank.
Yeah.
He should be reaching a gigantic audience with every essay that appears in Harper's.
He should be a person of a Paul Krugman status in terms of popular culture.
But he reaches a very substantial audience, a 230,000
right
audience.
What were your plans for bringing that in Harper's into the digital age? How would have you approached it?
Well, in the way that I've described, we were building this very flexible site kit that would allow us to publish to say an iPad. The iPad wasn't in existence when Paul designed this thing. But it would have been very easy. It would have just been another script to generate that. Now it's no big deal. Like y'all deal with that now all the time. I mean,
yeah, well, there's a million tools.
These tools are out there, but they weren't really there before. Right. I mean, you have the Atavist site kit.
And there's a gazillion.
You know, there are a bunch of them now.
900 clones that do the same.
So now there's no point. Now, I mean, I think Paul would be the first to say is that now all that stuff has been superseded. There are new, you know, it's now sort of a commodity.
Right.
You know? It's off the shelf. It can do all that stuff. So, I mean, now Harper's is on a tablet too.
But in a PDF format.
Yeah, the OA is the same kind of thing. The OA doesn't have the money to really generate a
native application.
A native app for the platform with all the bells and whistles. I hope eventually we'll be able to put it on one of these platforms we mentioned.
Yeah.
And there's so much we could do with the OA. I mean, with this music issue, to put music, you know, music samples and integrate them with pieces and video. We have a thing on our website right now with Dom Flemons playing Can You Blame the Colored Man on his banjo, which is just amazing. And you know, that's a beautiful thing we could do with an application on a tablet. We don't have that yet, but we will eventually. So all that stuff, all that history with Harper's is interesting to me, mostly because you know, we were prevented from doing things, but it's not unique.
Yeah.
It's not unique to have, the business side saying, no, how are you going to pay for it? What's the money? I mean, all of that's very sensible because you have to pay for it all. You can't just go out and spend the money without a plan for how you're going to get a return. But what's interesting to me is that it overlaps with the whole history of publishing over the last 20 years and how so many publications have guaranteed their obsolescence ultimately.
Yeah.
Or they've committed suicide by training readers to expect everything to be free. Like right. The newspapers who rushed into web publishing without figuring out how they were going to retain their print readers.
Well, it comes down to sort of what you said about, that's sensible to ask, how are you going to pay for this? But isn't it also sensible to say, hey, do you really think that these 230,000 print subscribers are all just going to hang around here forever, that this previous business model is going to sustain itself, and that when all these people die, who's going to replace them?
Yeah.
Who's going to do
that?
And
it's a different market, I think. I really do think that to a large extent, the people who are just going to read on paper are not the same as the people you reach online.
Yeah.
Some of them are. There's a lot of overlap. But a lot of people do both. I mean, I personally would rather read most long pieces on a piece of paper, in a magazine, a beautifully designed and printed magazine. Okay. I read a lot of stuff on tablets, too.
I come in from the opposite direction, although I definitely see the value of both. I mean, I think the biggest operative difference there isn't the reading experience. It's whether sharing things and whether the sort of communal aspects of reading are important to you and which one sort of mirrors mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. people you're around. For me, you know, sending people articles is actually a great part of the joy of being a reader. And it's disappointing to me at times when I'm like, you got to check this out. Come to my house and I'll give you the new Harper's, you know?
Yeah. And I love doing that too. And it's frustrating to me when things are not shareable.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't put the whole issue out on the web for a variety of reasons. But we do put out most of it eventually, you know, in time,
in chunks,
and you know, we put it out in sequence over the course of the cycle.
Yeah.
And we have enough material to where it works for us. Joe Hagan's piece on Charlie Rich just went up and has gotten a tremendous reception. And Joe's piece, I mean, it's an amazing piece of reporting. It's not just a piece of appreciation about a dead musician. He went to Memphis in search of Charlie Rich and people who knew Charlie Rich. And Natalie Rosenberg, who was an early producer of Rich when he was an R&B artist before he became a country guy, hands him a stack of letters that were from sent to the Charlie Rich fan club in 1972, written by all these 12-year-old girls who were in love with Charlie Rich, this 48-year-old gray-haired country singer. So what does Joe do? Joe is a great reporter. He's a staff reporter for New York Magazine. He tracked all the women down, those who were still alive that he could find, and built this piece around these women's experience of being completely in love with this star. So it's a piece about fandom, and it's a piece about love and longing and loneliness, because the music is so lonely. So we reprint some of these letters, and we put it up online. We didn't put it up online the first few weeks. We've been putting things out, like I said, in sequence. Tremendous response, and that response brings people to the magazine. I mean, ultimately, the Oxford American is a print magazine, and that's its identity. And there's no reason that everything has to be like everything else. There's plenty of room in the media world for us to have broadcast, radio, podcasts, you know, websites, tablets, and print. There's no reason that print has to go away, or there's no reason that it should go away. It's part of our, I mean, I think of part of our healthy media, you know, ecosystem, for lack of a better word. But we still want to be available on the digital platforms for people that want to read that way.
I think that this sort of print, not print argument is sometimes skewed to be about like, oh, do you like to read on your tablet or your print? And I think what it really comes down to more is, what do you do for the people who pay you, and what do you do for the people who don't pay you, and how much of your energy goes to only the people who are literally giving you money, and how much your energy goes to everyone regardless of whether they give you money. And from what I understand, at the tail end of your time at Harper's, I think it's pretty widely known that Rick MacArthur, who is the publisher of Harper's, believes pretty strongly that you should give people who don't pay nothing.
Right.
That's if nothing else, his opinion is very clear on the matter. And it's not an opinion that is very popular right now among anyone else or many other people. But it's a clear opinion, and I wonder how you've come to think about that, about where the Oxford American dollars go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Rick MacArthur's view makes a certain amount of sense. But how are you going to get your new readers? That's the question. And don't you want, I mean, my sense is, don't you want to be part of the larger conversation about politics or writing? Don't you want to be reaching that audience and that potential audience? And to my mind, it's just, we're going to put most of our energy into the print magazine, because that's that's what we do. That's our primary focus. That's it's through circulation and advertising in the print magazine that we derive our revenue and how we survive. So yes, we have to we're not going to put more in energy into those who are not paying for our product. But on the other hand, I think that this is how we get more people to be part of our literary community, is we reach them through the web and then hopefully they will subscribe. For me, like you said, it's not an either or.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of what is your business model so that you can sustain the thing you love.
Yeah.
And our business model is complex. It's not just circulation and advertising. We also are involved in other kinds of activities, like our restaurant and performance space south on Main and in Little Rock. We're hoping to do broadcasting out of that space eventually. And we have a partnership with NPR now that NPR just ran a piece in collaboration with us this past weekend. And we do a lot of video on the web. Dave Anderson's Lost, So Lost series won a National Magazine Award a couple of years ago for video. So we do invest quite a bit in our online publishing, just not as much as we do in the print. If at some point the revenue from advertising on the web will justify more, we'll certainly do more.
What is the experience of, we didn't really discuss you leaving Harper's, but being in an embattled position where you knew you were embattled, that you knew that you were in conflict with a person who was in some way in control of the destiny of the publication. Where did that leave you when you left and you came to Oxford American, having been through that?
Well, it's not so unusual.
Yeah.
And it's the fate of most editors-in-chief, after all.
Yeah.
To leave involuntarily. It's... So there's nothing particularly, I don't know that there was a lesson to be drawn from that. But the Oxford American has been a pure publishing experience for me, a pure editorial experience, because I didn't have that conflict with the business side. And the whole time I've been at the OA, everything has been perfectly in sync in terms of the mission. So it's just been a joy, really.
When you worked under MacArthur at Harper's, and I know that your predecessor at Oxford American was the founder and was someone who was very intrinsically tied to the identity of the magazine. So you have a certain amount of experience with sort of a centralized cult of personality exerting a lot of influence on a magazine. How do you avoid that yourself? How do you avoid making the Oxford American you?
My ambition for the OA is for it to be a writer's magazine, mm-hmm. not an editor's magazine. I'm not that fond of the idea of theme issues. We have a very successful franchise in music issues. And I think if you have four issues, one big theme issue a year is plenty.
Yeah.
What this speaks to is the idea of the question of being an editor's magazine or a writer's magazine, because when you have big themes, it's the editors coming up with the big ideas and the writers filling those ideas. Not the editors listening to the writers and figuring out what the writers are interested in. And the writers are the ones who are telling the stories. And so my approach is to listen to the writers, to give the writers an opportunity to tell their stories in the best possible way. And to bring them together in such a way that themes emerge. Right now we're putting together the spring issue is almost a hunting issue in a way. We have several pieces that involve hunting in one way or another. Steve Featherstone is writing about the Python Challenge in Florida, where all these hundreds of people went out to harvest Burmese pythons. And then there are other pieces about hunting as well, in one way or another, hunting. In some cases, hunting for God. But so I, as an editor, look at this material, look at these writers, look at these texts, and say, okay, well, this what kind of a pattern is emerging? let's put these pieces together in this issue. And so it's not about me, really. I get some aesthetic satisfaction out of putting all this stuff together and making a coherent whole with the artwork and all the writing and the compositional aspects of that. But really, it's about the writers. It's about Roseanne Cash. It's about Joe Hagan. It's about John Jeremiah Sullivan. It's about Amanda Petrusik. It's about Jamie Quattro. It's about these writers telling their stories. It's about Lucy Alibar, Carl the Raping Goat Saves Christmas. This is an amazing story. So when I feel kind of embarrassed that we've been talking about my career, because to me, my career isn't all that interesting. Insofar as I've been an editor, I'm much more interested in talking about writers and stories. And that's the main thing, is telling these stories, creating this platform, this context for the best possible storytelling, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, essay. It's all storytelling.
I don't think we're going to have a better place to end than that. Thank you for coming in, Roger.
My pleasure.
Check out Oxford American. We'll link to it in the show notes. The music issue is on the newsstands now, and we'll be back next week.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Roger Hodge for coming in. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff, our editor, Lauren Kirchner, our intern, Sarah Button. If you want to support this podcast, maybe check out a story from The Atavist. Go to longform.org and come see us next week right here.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Teen Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Teen Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.